This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. When you type stuff into your web browser, your computer or your smartphone starts suggesting things, right? As soon as you start typing in the box, it's predicting what it thinks you want. Same thing when you text. Your phone auto-completes your thoughts or maybe suggests the perfect emoji. You share your data, I share mine, and everyone gets to share in that benefit of a smarter, data-trained machine, right? Very time-saving, right? Well, it might come with a little bit of a deal with the devil, how we get all that convenience, right? It's sort of a technological deal with the devil. But can you get those crowdsourced benefits and preserve your privacy? There's the devil in the details. Google's Chrome browser used something called differential privacy to achieve that goal. And a few weeks ago, at Apple's Worldwide Developers Conference, Craig Federighi hinted that Apple's getting into the same game.
Differential privacy is a research topic in the area of statistics and data analytics that uses hashing, subsampling, and noise injection to enable this kind of crowdsourced learning while keeping the information of each individual user completely private.
Hashing, subsampling, noise injection, lots of techno babble. But we have a few folks who might help to straighten that out and tell us what's really going on. Cynthia Dwork is the co-creator of Differential Privacy and a distinguished scientist at Microsoft. She's based in Mountain View, California. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you. You're welcome. Matthew Green is an assistant professor at the Information Security Institute at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me.
And our listeners who want to get in on the conversation, 844-724-8255, 844-SciTalk. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Dr. Dwork, you invented English language definition of what differential privacy is, something a little less technical than what Greg mentioned in his keynote?
Yes. So we invented the mathematical definition, and the English language definition says essentially this. The outcome of any statistical analysis is essentially equally likely, independent of whether any individual chooses to opt into the data set or to opt out of the data set. So in other words, essentially the same things can happen to me with basically the same probabilities, whether I have allowed my data to be used in the data analysis or if I have withheld my data.
Wow, that does seem like magic. Matthew Green, can you give us an example of what she was talking about?
Well, so there's a very old statistical technique called randomized response, which we use to ask people questions they might not want to answer honestly, like, have you ever stolen from your employer? And the basic idea with this technique, which is one example of a differentially private technique, is that when I ask you that question, you flip a coin. If it comes up heads, you answer honestly. And if it comes up tails, you answer at random. And the basic idea there is that if I see your response, I don't really learn much about what you individually did. But if I can aggregate many, many different responses, and I compute a statistical average, the number of people who are going to answer that question positively, I can subtract away the noise and I can learn things that are useful to me.
So you can basically hide the response through mathematical noise, so to speak. So we don't know who actually made the response. And that's why, Dr. Dwork, you say it's 50-50 whether we know or don't know who it was.
Actually, in the example that Matthew just gave, we may know exactly who is responding, but because of the randomness that's introduced in the procedure for generating the yes or no, I stole from my employer, we don't actually know if a yes means it really happened or if the person is saying yes because the coin flips said to say yes. And so even if we knew exactly who it was, we still would only have a vague statistical hint as to whether they actually did or did not engage in the behavior. And these statistical hints, while telling us nothing about the individual or very, very little about the individual, can be aggregated over many individuals to understand the fraction of people who cheated from their employers.
Without giving away who that individual was.
Exactly.
So we know about the whole population, Matthew, but we don't know anything about the individuals in them.
That's correct.
And is this what Apple is doing in their new iPhone system? that's going to be launched.
So it appears that they're using a variant of this technique, this randomized response technique. And what it does is almost exactly the same thing, except they're taking that technique and they're kind of putting it on steroids. So instead of just asking one question about what your phone has done today, they can ask very complicated questions like, for example, did you erase a word when you were writing a message and replace it with an emoji? And they can learn from that. Once they aggregate many people's information, they can learn, well, are people commonly using this emoji instead of a particular word? And they can take that information and use that to make that a suggestion to other people as well.
So what do you say to people, Dr. Dwork, who are afraid that their privacy is being compromised here?
I think it's quite a challenge to articulate the nature of a probabilistic guarantee. You know, I need to improve my ability to teach the public understanding of risk here.
But so would you say then they shouldn't be worried? I'll put it very simply like that. Don't worry, they're not giving away whom you are.
Yes, that's what I would say.
Okay. That's very simple. Now, I understand. Let's talk about Microsoft. I know Microsoft is working with a power company in California to implement some of this differential privacy technology. Is that right? What does that have to do with the power grid?
Well, your individual power consumption can actually reveal quite a bit about you. It can even reveal which movies you're watching, because the patterns of when the screen lights up are very distinctive for a movie, and that takes a certain amount of power. So the California Public Utilities Commission requires certain reporting on smart grid data. And this is aggregate reporting. Mm-hmm. And there's a question about how the data ought to be aggregated. And the administrative law judge made one proposal, which is, of course, the law. But a power company in Southern California is exploring using differential privacy as an easier and more powerful technology to at least comply with the spirit of the law.
I see. As the Internet of Things takes off, you know, we're going to have sensors in everything we wear, we drive, things like that. Is this definition of differential privacy, this is something that we should get used to hearing, because this is how this data will be collected? Matthew?
I can't predict the future.
I hope so. I mean, if companies that are building IoT, Internet of Things devices, start building in privacy protections of any kind, we're going to be a lot better off than we are today.
Mm-hmm. And can it be made stronger? Or, you know, what kind of research can you do on it to make it better?
So any kind of disclosure leaks a little bit of information. And there's a fundamental law of information recovery which says that overly accurate estimates of too many statistics can completely eventually destroy privacy. And this can no more be circumvented than can be the laws of physics. The goal of algorithmic research on differential privacy is to postpone this inevitability and to push to the theoretical limits.
So you have to decide how much I understand what you're saying. There's a trade-off here between collecting more data and less privacy, or more privacy and less data, and you want to find a comfort zone there, because it'll start leaking some of that information about the person. Would that be right, Matthew?
Right. So eventually, you know, if I ask you the same question every day and you answer that question, even if you randomize your answers and add noise, over time, I'm going to learn something about you if you continue to answer honestly. And so the danger there, of course, there are other questions you could ask me that are correlated with that first question. So instead of asking me, did I steal from my employer, you could ask me, have I ever stolen from anybody? And so the danger there is actually answering all of those very specific questions of how often should I ask the question, how should the question be phrased, and what do I do to prevent that information from eventually being tied to a person?
Mm-hmm. Because if you ask it enough times, you might get a better answer. You have to actually, I guess, figure out where that differential point is about the question and the answer, and how much. Good.
So what differential privacy lets you do is it lets you measure the cumulative privacy loss over many analyses so that you can scale your noise accordingly in order to stay safe. But eventually your answers will become pure noise.
It will become pure noise, which...
Eventually.
Which means the answers are worthless?
Overly accurate estimates of too many statistics is blatantly non-private. There's no
right.
getting around that.
So if you become too accurate, you give up privacy. But so what you want...
And it has nothing to do with differential privacy. This is
yeah.
just a fact.
Okay. So then you want to have enough privacy, but not too much, so that you can get some of the information out. And we have to, you and the technologists have to decide where that comfort zone is.
Where the comfort zone is an interesting question. If I were to say to you, is a week a long time? What's the answer to that question? I don't know. It depends. It depends on the context. And humans have developed some notions about the value of time. Similarly, we have a particular measure of privacy loss, and we need to develop a real understanding of what these numbers mean and in which contexts.
Mm-hmm. In other words, would I be willing to give up some of the convenience of texting ahead and having it guess what I want, but get a little bit more privacy?
Well, to be clear, these systems right now are opt-in. So you do have the option to mm-hmm. opt out if you feel like you don't trust this technology now. But just to be clear, you know, on a daily basis, we type things into Google that we probably wouldn't tell our closest friends. So anything that improves over what's currently being done in the tech industry is probably going to be a big improvement.
All right. We're going to leave it at that. Thank you both. Cynthia Dwar, co-creator of Differential Privacy. Distinguished scientist at Microsoft. She's based out there in Mountain View, California. Matthew Green, assistant professor at the Information Security Institute on the other coast at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today, and have a happy holiday weekend. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about how new DNA vaccines for Zika virus work and take a look at why we're running short on stores for another older vaccine for yellow fever. Oh, yeah, stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. The Zika virus is now active in over 50 countries around the world. And while it's not spreading here in the U.S. via mosquitoes yet, mosquito season is here. And nearly 1,000 travelers have already been infected and returned to the U.S. with the virus. But as the virus has been advanced, new vaccine candidates have been racing along, too. And a couple of them have already passed animal tests. They're ready for prime time. We have phase one human trials, including a sort of unusual vaccine for humans, at least, a DNA vaccine. Here to tell us how it works is Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases at NIH in Bethesda. He's also National Medal of Science recipient. Welcome back to Science Friday. Been a while, Dr. Fauci.
Yes, good to be with you, Ira.
So how many Zika vaccines are ready for human trial?
Well, there are about a half a dozen that are at various stages of preclinical studies, as you mentioned, in vitro and in animal models. Some of them are federal government-driven, some are in collaboration with industry, and some are done by industry alone. The one that you mentioned that is very close to going into a phase one trial, there are actually a couple of versions of the same vaccine. You mentioned DNA vaccine. Well, this is a vaccine that has actually been used in the past for a similar type of a virus, a flavivirus called West Nile virus, which is in the same general family and genus as Zika virus is. And what it is a plasmid or a circular component of DNA in which you can insert a gene or genes that expresses a particular protein of the virus in question. In this case, the virus in question is Zika, and the particular protein is a particular component of the outer coating. And when you inject this into an individual, into the muscle, what it does, it codes for a protein, and the protein takes the form of a small virus-like particle, which the body makes a very good immune response against. And we saw that in in a different disease with West Nile, but what you refer to also correctly was that just recently, over the past week or so, there have been reports in the medical literature of the prototype of this virus, as well as another virus that was injected into mice and protected the mice from challenge with two different types of Zika virus. So A, it induces a rather robust immune response, and at least in a mouse model, it protects. Now, a mouse model is not, you know, the optimal model for comparing to humans, but there are a couple of people and companies that are going into now the non-human primate model to do the identical mm-hmm. types of experiments.
Could we be having a couple of different ones that win out and not just one winner?
Oh, absolutely. I think whenever you're dealing with a vaccine, there are so many uncertainties in vaccines that, you could have a few successful ones, and you want to have several in the pipeline to just cover your bets so that in case one fails or there's technical problems with the production of one or more, that you have a few candidates. So I think when you're dealing with a vaccine of any type, the general rule is to always go with multiple candidates so that you really have backup in case there's failure. And if you have multiple successes, yeah. all the better.
There was news also about a harmless bacteria carried by bees and butterflies that might stop the spread of Zika by infecting the mosquitoes.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, tell us a little bit where that is.
Okay, so that's what a bacteria called Wolbachia. Wolbachia is a bacteria that can harmlessly infect a variety of insects. You mentioned a couple, but it can also infect mosquitoes, and it has two components to it. It interferes with the propagation of the mosquitoes, but it also does not allow the mosquito to successfully transmit the particular pathogen in question. In this question, it would be Zika. There have been a number of studies that were done in Australia successfully using it in mosquitoes in Australia, and there are tests that are planned to be done under the appropriate control conditions here in the United States and in South America.
Were you disappointed by Congress not taking up Zika virus before they went away for the weekend?
More than disappointed, Ira. It was really disturbing because, you know, we do need the money to continue to proceed in a variety of areas. The CDC, which is very heavily involved in South America, in the Caribbean, and particularly in Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico is very vulnerable. They're having about 1% per week of the population being infected already, and we haven't even gotten into the peak mosquito season there in our territory of Puerto Rico. We, with our vaccine trials, we will start a vaccine phase one trial at the end of August, at the latest the beginning of September, and there are a number of other candidates that will be not too far behind that or even at the same pace as that. And the phase one trial generally takes a couple of months. It's a small trial for safety and to determine if you induce a response that you would predict would be protective. But right after that, if you want to smoothly transition into an efficacy trial, namely to determine if it works, that would likely start in the beginning of 2017, like January or so in 2017. In order to prepare for that larger phase two trial, we need to start preparing the sites now. And we are very rapidly running out of money, even the money that we've moved from other accounts to keep us going. So we're reaching that point both at the NIH and at the CDC, is that we really need some action about appropriating this money.
So the trials will not go on if you don't get the money?
Well, no, the phase 2B trials, yes. Right. The phase 1 we can do with what we have, but the phase 2 would likely stop short if we don't get money, which is something we don't want to happen, because even though they will be initiated in the early part of 2017, we want a smooth transition from phase 1 right into phase 2B, which won't happen if we don't get the money.
And you know, summer's coming up and the mosquitoes are moving.
We're right now, as you mentioned, we have about 1,000 travel-related cases in the continental United States. We have over 250 pregnant women among those cases that we have in the continental United States. And as we get into the mosquito season, particularly in the southeastern part in the Gulf Coast area, where we have seen pockets of outbreak of other similar viruses like dengue and chikungunya, yeah, it's concerning that we may have and likely will have localized outbreaks of Zika on the continent of the United States. And the thing we absolutely have to do is to prevent them from becoming sustained and from becoming disseminated.
All right, Dr. Fauci, I want to thank you for taking time to be with us today, and good luck and a happy holiday to you. Anthony Fauci, who is director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland. And now a look to the skies and some of the objects in our solar system. A paper published last week in the journal Geophysical Research Letters outlines why cold, distant Pluto is still very likely to have a liquid ocean buried deep beneath its icy surface. How can this be? It turns out that the planet shows signs of recent expansion. Expansion is seen in images from New Horizon, the spacecraft that flew by, and this research calculates that the most likely explanation is the slow conversion of liquid water to ice, which takes up more space. You know, ice, actually, water expands when it freezes. So to make that happen, of course, you need that liquid water, possibly as deep as 50 kilometers. Here to tell this story are the two co-authors on that research paper. Noah Hammond, a graduate student in the Department of Earth, Environmental, and Planetary Science at Brown University. Amy Barr Milinar is a senior scientist at Planetary Science Institute. Welcome to Science Friday.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Let's talk about, Noah, walk us through your finding. How do we know there's an ocean on Pluto?
Well, it's really extraordinary. New Horizons flew past Pluto last year and saw images on the surface of these cracks, long tectonic cracks, which were interpreted as extensional tectonic features. And as you said, when an ocean is slowly freezing, that can cause Pluto to get bigger. Pluto expands. So what we did was we ran some calculations called, you know, thermal evolution models. Basically, we started with Pluto soon after it formed, and we determined how quickly is it going to lose its heat over geologic time. And we determined that Pluto probably still has an ocean today if those extensional features on the surface are present.
Wow. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Pluto is far from the sun, doesn't seem to have any major tidal forces acting on it. So what kind of energy is keeping that water liquid underneath there?
Well, what it has is these, we think Pluto is made up of an ice shell on the surface, probably about 150 kilometers thick, and then an ocean. Then it has this rocky core.
Right.
And in that core are these heat-producing elements. We actually have the same heat-producing elements in the Earth's crust. It's like uranium, potassium. These just give off heat as they decay over time. And that little bit amount of energy is enough to keep an ocean sustained on Pluto.
Hmm. Dr. Molina, one of the factors that the model relies on is a substance called ICE2. Sounds like a movie. What's going on with that?
Well, there are actually several different phases of water ice. The phase of ice that we're familiar with in our everyday life is called ICE1, and that's the phase of ice that floats on water. But then as ice is compressed, like at high pressures inside Pluto's interior, the crystal structure actually changes and it becomes denser. So if you compress ice under very cold conditions, you get this phase of ice called ICE2. And so when you compress the ice like this, Pluto can undergo net contraction. And when that ice melts, then Pluto undergoes net expansion.
Noah Hammer, what has New Horizons contributed to our understanding of Pluto and Pluto's composition? It has really sent back a lot of data, hasn't it?
Oh, it sure has. It's seen a number of really extraordinary things on the surface. There are these nitrogen ices, which appear to be convecting and refreshing the surface, making it look very geologically young. And I think what we really focused on was the extensional tectonic features, because it's really great that we can look at what's on the surface to infer what's on the inside. And if Pluto has an ocean, that has really profound implications for astrobiology and the rest of the solar system, if liquid water can exist in such a cold, dark place.
Well, I hear you hinting about life here when you
say
astrobiology.
Well, I don't want to get carried away.
I want to make sure we're on the record about what you're talking about. So you're not hinting. When you say astrobiology, what do you mean by that?
Well, you know, we know that liquid water on Earth is essential for life. So when any time you discover liquid water as a possibility on another planet or dwarf planet or moon, it gets astrobiologists excited.
So take us beyond Pluto, because Pluto has now been classified as a dwarf planet by some, and there are other, as you say, other dwarf planets out there. Take us beyond Pluto. Do they have findings have indications or implications for the rest of our solar system?
Amy, do you want to take that?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that's really amazing about this result is that it looks like Pluto, like a lot of other icy bodies in our solar system, have an ocean. And it certainly wasn't expected when we, you know, went out to Jupiter's moons with the Galileo mission, or to the moons of Saturn with Cassini, or, you know, to Pluto with New Horizons. We didn't expect to find oceans in any of these icy bodies.
Yeah.
And now it looks like that's a really common feature for icy bodies, you know, both
right.
moons of the outer planets and Kuiper Belt objects as well. And so what's really interesting to me is the possibility that perhaps maybe other Kuiper Belt objects might have moons,
right.
maybe, you know, excuse me, oceans. You know, oceans appear to be common features in the outer solar system. And that's really surprising. That's definitely not something that we expected.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. I spoke to Alan Stern, one of your compatriots on the New Horizons project early this week, and he said it seems like we are Earth is the outlier. We have the external ocean. Everybody else has an internal ocean.
That's true.
That is absolutely amazing, don't you think? Let's talk about what the next questions to tackle about Pluto and the bodies like. What else do you want to know, Noah? What's there to learn?
Well, I think it would be really great if we could, you know, understand how thick the ocean is and what its chemical composition is. Obviously, that's going to be really hard to do since it's underneath, you know, 150 miles of ice. But, you know, it's not too early to start thinking about the next mission to Pluto. Even though it takes a long time to get there, one thing we learned is that it was definitely worth it to go, and that Pluto has so many mysteries that are yet to be solved that were revealed by this mission.
Amy, what would you like to learn?
Well, I'm really interested in how Pluto formed. I'm interested in its very earliest history and, you know, how Charon formed, you know, what did that impact look like? How did Pluto, you know, evolve immediately following the impact? How did Charon evolve after the impact? And I'm also interested in what that can tell us about how the other Kuiper Belt objects may have formed.
And so we're not quite, should we hit the inner moons like Europa and Enceladus before we hit Pluto? Because they both have oceans also?
Well, maybe you can hit them on the way.
Yeah. Well, we already are planning on going back to Europa, and the European Space Agency is planning a mission to Ganymede, so I think we're going to get really good data for those. I would love to have a return to Enceladus, but I agree with Noah, a return mission to Pluto would be really phenomenal as well.
But there's nothing in the works at the moment. You have to have a lot of money for that, right?
Yeah, Pluto's far away.
Yeah, and but you have spacecraft to travel pretty fast now, don't you?
Yeah, yeah.
Hopefully, with the development of the Space Launch System, you should be able to get to the outer solar system a lot faster. So that's something we're really excited about.
All right. Well, we'll be following the excitement along with you. Noah Hammond, graduate student in the Department of Earth, Environmental and Planetary Sciences at Brown University. Dr. Amy Barr-Millar is a senior scientist at the Planetary Science Institute. Thank you both for... Molinar, I'm sorry, I mispronounced your name. Dr. Molina, I'm sure, like I am, everybody mispronounces your name.
No, it's all right.
Thank you. Have a great weekend. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Ira.
After the break, a different story from another dwarf planet. What has NASA's Dawn mission found out about Ceres? Yeah, they're all out there, those dwarf planets. Maybe we'll get to a few of them. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about the planets, dwarf planets in our solar system. We were talking about Pluto, and so we're going to go from the smallest planet in our solar system now to the largest.
It's a monster. It's unforgiving. It's relentless.
No, that is not a clip from Shark Week special. They're talking about Jupiter, the giant planet that had all the ingredients to be a star. If only it had been a little bigger. Well, what you just heard is a sample of NASA's trailer for the Juno mission. That's the orbiter that will soon begin to explore Jupiter. Our closest look yet, the Juno mission asks, where in the solar system did Jupiter actually form? Why is the great red spot shrinking? Does this gaseous giant have a solid core? But first, the Juno craft has to successfully insert into Jupiter's orbit, braving fast-moving debris, powerful radiation in the process. And that event is slated for a late Monday night, Independence Day. Forget the movie. This is Juno, Independence Day. And here to tell us more about Juno and what we may learn is my guest, Michelle Thaler. She's an astrophysicist and deputy director of science communication for NASA. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hey, it's great to be here, Ira. Thank you very much.
Juno was your idea of a 4th of July party at NASA, right?
No kidding. Yes, and that actually was a complete coincidence. We didn't mean for it to get there on that day, but it's a wonderful time to celebrate for all of us, so I'm not complaining.
No, no one is. You know, we've been looking at Jupiter for a long time, since Galileo and on. What can Juno tell us about Jupiter that the spacecraft Galileo and Cassini and all those others did not?
Wow, there's so many things. The really dramatic thing about this mission is how close we're getting. We're in this amazing orbit that takes us just almost kind of skimming over the cloud tops of Jupiter at an altitude of about 3,000 miles. And that puts us well within the very intense, very dangerous radiation belts of Jupiter. So we've never really gotten so close to the planet. Now, as you said, the Galileo spacecraft did actually drop a probe into the atmosphere of Jupiter, but it was only able to really get an up-close sample of Jupiter in that one location. And it turns out that we might have had a bit of bad luck. We might have actually landed in a kind of anomalous place in Jupiter. There are fundamental questions like, what is the core like? What is the magnetic field like? What are the clouds made of? That we can really only answer very up close and personal.
Interesting, because I thought we knew so much. You see pictures of Jupiter, graphics all the time, and they peel it back, they show you the inside, whatever, but those are just graphics, is what you're saying.
Well, that's right. I mean, we actually don't know the size of Jupiter's core, the density of the core. One of the big questions is there some large rocky body underneath all of that, thousands and thousands of miles of gas and also liquid hydrogen? And in this case, we're going to be getting so close to Jupiter that the gravity, the way the spacecraft responds to the gravity of Jupiter alone should tell us what the core is like. So that's never been done before. And the radiation belts are so intense that they block out a lot of the very detailed measurements you could make of the content of oxygen, of water, of methane. A lot of this information just doesn't get through those intense radiation belts.
That was a cool sound, was it not? Can you tell us what that was, or should I fill him in? Why don't you do it?
Oh, sure. That was actually from an instrument called WAVES on board the Juno spacecraft. And what you were listening to there was the radio waves that we recorded when we basically hit the sonic boom, we hit the shock wave that Jupiter makes with respect to the solar wind. The sun has this wonderful, very diffuse wind of high-energy particles. It travels at about 1,000,000 miles an hour. And Jupiter's magnetic field is so strong that these wind particles sort of shock around it, actually sort of create a bow shock that we call it. And so that was the sound that Juno made on June 24th as it actually passed into the magnetic realm of Jupiter.
So this is pretty harsh environment that it's going to be passing through.
Oh, it's incredible. So, I mean, there's never been a spacecraft that's had to withstand this much radiation. You know, on here on Earth, you know, going around, the unit of radiation intensity is called a rad. And here on Earth, we experience about a third of a rad. That's about the radiation level you and I are at right now. Over the course of its lifetime, Juno is going to experience tens of millions of rads.
Wow.
So, yeah, I mean, we had to make this thing really, really solid and built to last.
Does it have, like, the protection on it, like, you know, armor, things like that, to protect it from this?
Oh, absolutely. So all of the instruments, and this is a new idea. This is the first time we're trying it this way. All of the science instruments on Juno are actually in a vault. They're in this 400-pound titanium box. And it's in there to survive the radiation of Jupiter. Now, the Juno spacecraft is only going to be orbiting Jupiter a little bit more than 2 years. I mean, we think eventually the radiation will just fry us. I mean, we know that's going to happen. But we have some cameras and very sensitive instrumentation in there that should survive the whole mission lifetime in that vault.
Wow. And so Jupiter then will have the kind of death of other spacecraft that have entered into its realm and go plunging into the planet?
Yes, we call that the Viking funeral. Yeah, absolutely. So after its science mission, in February 2018 is the planned date that we will deliberately plunge Juno down into Jupiter where it will burn up. And that was the same fate that the Galileo spacecraft suffered. That was back in 2003. And in the case of Galileo, you know, that one of the reasons we did that was to make sure that the spacecraft never landed in the pristine environments of places like Europa, you know, the moon of Jupiter, which has a liquid water ocean under the ice.
Because you don't want to contaminate it?
Exactly. Yeah, we need to be very careful about that.
But you will be collecting data as it goes down through?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Yeah, there's actually a number of wonderful sort of Viking burials coming up. We have the Cassini spacecraft as well that will be doing a planned entry into the planet Saturn. And both Juno and Cassini, of course, we want to know as much as we can all the way down.
Wow, you know, because that Cassini, it's been, what a workhorse has it been.
It's been amazing. And, you know, the images are so beautiful that I always have to sort of stop people and say, you know, this is not a special effect. This is not computer generated. We've had this amazing spacecraft around Saturn for more than 10 years.
And so when will we start seeing pictures and data coming back from Juno?
So that's the thing that we've been trying to make sure everybody understands. The orbit insertion, which happens July 4th, is a risky, you know, really sort of high tension maneuver, and the cameras and the science instruments have all been shut off into a protective mode. So we're not going to get images back immediately. We hope to have some images that the camera took, which is called JunoCam, as it approached Jupiter. We have one image that we've already released. We hope to have maybe a movie of the moons of Jupiter going around. But then the real action starts later in the summer. In late August, we will begin to release some images of the poles of Jupiter, and this will be the first time we've had a clear view of the north and south poles and the giant auroras of Jupiter. And then come November, we're going to go into main science operations, and we're actually going to ask the public to help us decide where we should aim the camera.
Oh, come on.
Absolutely.
Are we voting? How do we vote? I mean, are you going to give us a choice of where to go? Oh, how does that work?
On NASA's website, there will be several different locations that we think there's really interesting stuff to look at. And we are going to have the public vote on what they would most like to see. So absolutely, you have a chance to help us, you know, choose where to aim this wonderful camera that will be taking the highest resolution images of Jupiter ever taken.
Wow. I'm waiting for that. I'm going to go to the website. Now, I understand that Juno's been doing some new things for a NASA mission, certainly. You have a movie-like trailers out. Trent mm-hmm. Reznor of Nine Inch Nails made a soundtrack, right?
Yes,
people,
yes.
And as you say, people can vote where to point the camera. There are also Lego figurines on board.
There are.
Tell, what is that?
Yes, three Lego figurines. There's a Lego figurine of Jupiter, of course, the god Jupiter, you know, the namesake of the planet, and also Jupiter's wife, Juno. You know, Juno is named for Jupiter's wife. The other moons of Jupiter tend to be named after Jupiter's lovers, so we're sending his wife out to keep an eye on him. And then the other Lego minifigure is Galileo. And there's a wonderful quote, an excerpt from Galileo's first observations of the moons of Jupiter all along for the ride. The little figures are actually in spacecraft-grade aluminum, And there's a wonderful collaboration with the Lego company to bring Lego minifigures out to Jupiter.
Do you have a camera on them so we can see them while they're out there on Juno?
Well, you won't be able to see them when they're on Juno. We certainly have pictures of them that you can look at online. So if you just Google Juno Lego minifigs, you can see them there.
Now, I've been following NASA missions for a long, long time, but I don't remember trying to get the public this involved in so many different ways on a mission to a planet before. What's the idea? You're trying to create, make the public realize how exciting this is?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I really have always been inspired by how much the public likes NASA, and I'm so lucky that I get to go out and give talks about this stuff and kind of get that from people. But this really is, all of us on the planet are in this together. And mm-hmm. science is not something that is an isolated group of people that are doing off in some ivory tower. I think that as especially as younger scientists, I'm always on social media. I'm always connected with all my friends. It feels odd to me that there would be a large segment of the population that wouldn't be participating in this, be with us.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why we're doing that.
That sounds great. I want to thank you, Michelle, for taking time to be with us today.
Oh, it was wonderful, Ira. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Michelle Thaler, astrophysicist and NASA Deputy Director of Science Communication. She's the Juno mission spokesperson out there in the JPL in Pasadena, California. I want to bring on another. There's so much going on in the solar system now, so much exploration. Let's turn to another close dwarf planet, close to Pluto, Ceres. Ceres is the giant of the asteroid belt. And last year, NASA's Dawn spacecraft arrived at Ceres to get our first close look. And now research published in Nature suggests that liquid water, again, more water we have out there, has played a role in the planet's geology, perhaps very recently. Here to explain these findings and other news from Dawn is my next guest, Carol Raymond, Deputy Principal Investigator of the NASA Dawn mission to Ceres and co-author of two research papers concerning Ceres. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
I had to do everything I could not to play the Four Seasons music when you came on, but I'm sure you've played that yourself a few times. Do you understand what I'm talking about?
Not exactly.
You're not old enough to remember Dawn, a song that they...
Oh, yes, of course.
Of course. Okay, I've got that trivia out of the way. Tell us about this mission. What makes this so special? What are you trying to accomplish there?
Well, Ceres is actually more than an asteroid. It's really a designated a dwarf planet, but it is a protoplanetary remnant left over from the very first epoch of solar system formation. So when the small planetesimals were accreting and they were merging to form protoplanets, and then those protoplanets were going on to form the planets that we know today, there were many, many objects in the solar system that were probably similar to Ceres. But Ceres is the only object that we know of in the inner solar system, which is a large, primitive protoplanet. And so by going to Ceres and studying it, we're able to look back in time and better understand what processes were going on during the time of the planet formation.
What makes you say it's primitive? How do you distinguish primitive from a more mature one?
So primitive is a relative word, of course. The far reaches of the outer solar system contain the most primitive material from our solar nebula. But in the inner solar system, we use that term to describe a body which is rich in volatiles. And of course, volatiles are just light elements, and the most familiar one to us is water, and the most important one perhaps. So we're looking for water-rich, carbon-rich, and organic-rich bodies, which are retaining a lot of that initial material that was around when the planetesimals were forming. And Ceres is that type of object, and we knew that before the Dawn spacecraft went out to mm-hmm. visit it, because we knew how big it was, and we knew how massive it was because of how it perturbs other bodies around it, other asteroids. And so we knew that its density indicated it wasn't made of a solid rock. It was made either of a very porous rock or a mixture of rock and lighter elements like ice.
Gotcha. I'm Ira Plato. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. And so this is a unique object that we've never studied this kind before.
That's right.
What's the best picture we can paint so far of what Ceres looks like? We've talked a lot about Pluto. What does, if I were to look at it or be there, what would the terrain be like?
Well, what you see is mainly a very dusty surface. It's covered with what we call a lag deposit. And the lag is what's left over after volatile sublimate. So this is like what's left over when the snowbank melts on the street of, you know, Washington, D.C. And so this is a kind of a dark and dusty material. But in addition to that kind of background, we're seeing the most fantastic formations of bright material dotting the surface, mostly associated with impact craters, but also curiously occurring along fracture patterns in the surface. So we've got a surface which has many very interesting geological features. I mentioned the fractures. There are large troughs on the surface, and then there are many smaller fractures in sort of chaotic radial patterns, as well as concentric ones, which mm-hmm. follow the circular outlines of the impact craters. So those are the main elements of what makes up the surface, and then of the you know the sort of geology
right.
of the surface. And then we have also a two major highlands, and then two major lowlands. So there is some relief on Ceres, and we're still puzzling out what that might be telling us.
You know, when you look at them, we haven't gotten close-ups, but now we get closer to them. They don't just look like little rocks out there. They look like real places.
This is a geological world. It is a small planet, and what we're understanding now, based in part on the research that was published yesterday, is that this appears to be a geologically active world. The deposits of very bright material that we were able to see as soon as we got in the vicinity of Ceres, these were the blinding bright spots that captured everybody's attention. Turns out that these are bright areas in the floor of a young crater, about 80 million years old, called O'Cotter. And if you look in detail at that bright material, it's a very curious domed structure that's in a pit in the middle
wow.
of the crater.
Wow.
And it has a radial fracture pattern on top of it. And so just looking at it, it is giving you the impression
okay.
that material is coming up from below and
got
pushing
it.
The surface up.
Dr. Raymond, I got to go. This is quite exciting. Kyle Raymond, Deputy Principal Investigator of NASA's Dawn mission. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
And a last nod to Jupiter. We're going to go out with a selection from that new composition by Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross. They created in celebration of the Juno mission using some recordings of Jupiter itself. One last thing. There's a 50-foot-tall beehive looming in London's Kew Gardens. Or is it there? It's actually a sculpture with light and sound effects triggered by the activity of real bees. And you can see that on our website at sciencefriday.com/hive. B.J. Lederman composed our main theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. Have a great and safe 4th of July. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.